Behind every closed door and every high-profile trial lies a truth the cameras never quite captured. You've seen the headlines, but maybe that's not the full story. This is Debriefed.
A superstar career collapses into a murder conviction and a prison death that raises new questions.
A neighborhood shooting turns into a national argument about race, fear, and self-defense.
Four college students killed in a house that never expected a target.
Three cases, three different endings, and none of them leave the same question behind. This is Debriefed, and I'm Sean, and what's left over is up for discussion. Today, we look at three different cases with three very different facts. We have Jennifer, Savannah, and Megan here. And each of them have brought a case that sparks debate after the headlines are over. Aaron Hernandez was a tight end for the New England Patriots when he was arrested in 2013 for the murder of Odin Lloyd. He was convicted in 2015 and later died by suicide in prison after being acquitted in a double homicide case. Jennifer is leading this case because she followed the story closely as a lifelong Patriots fan and has been particularly interested in the possible role of CTE. Jennifer.
Yes.
Tell us about the case.
This case is just crazy to me. This is a guy who basically had his whole life in front of him. He just signed a multi-million dollar contract. He scored a touchdown in the Super Bowl that they lost to the Giants. But, yes, I know. The crazy thing is it was also very circumstantial. They never found the murder weapon. They used basically the timeline and home security footage from the dumping ground, and the prosecution was able to piece it all together to get the guilty verdict. Now, the circumstantial evidence was overwhelming. He texted his two friends from Connecticut. They came out to pick him up. They texted Lloyd to go pick him up in Boston. Lloyd texted his sister that night, three cryptic texts. I think it was like, you saw who I was with, NFL, just so you know. And they got out of the car together, him and Hernandez, and only Hernandez got back into the car. His two associates, or whatever you want to call them, that were with him that night testified to that in court. There was footage of him back in his house with what looked like a handgun, which they never found. That's where the circumstantial stuff was. His fiance was initially charged with hiding that, too. It never was found. She eventually, the charges
but
were
wasn't,
dropped.
Wasn't there something where she... accordingly, there was a video of her taking something to the garbage.
A box.
A box. Mm-hmm. Yep. There was a video of her taking this box.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. But they were never able to piece it together, and two together. So they dropped the charges against her.
Okay.
But they did find DNA on a piece of chewing gum that was stuck to the shell casings at the, was it a junkyard?
It was a junkyard.
It
was an underdeveloped place that they're in the process of
developing. Super close to his house, I think within 5 miles of his home.
Yep.
And they were able to just piece all of this together to come up with a very credible timeline. He also gave his phone to the police in pieces, and he destroyed his home security footage.
Like when you say in pieces, here's my phone.
In pieces. Yeah, in pieces. And hired a professional cleaning crew to clean his house.
Yeah.
Innocent people tend not to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I have professionals clean my house sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I do too. I have somebody come in every other week, but like, I don't hire them specifically after somebody was murdered.
I mean, very true.
So that is how it all came together. And I just remember the hoopla around his contract. And he met with Robert Kraft 2 days after the body was discovered.
Yeah.
Robert Kraft actually testified at his trial.
Okay.
Not about anything that happened, just about the conversation they had those 2 days after the body was found.
What were the conversations 2 days after?
Basically, he said, I had nothing to do with this.
Got it. So he came in for the defense probably.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. But he got let go from the Patriots.
Yep.
But did
he get let go before the arrest?
No, after the arrest, but before the conviction.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. Super interesting. I know we're going to talk about his suicide in jail,
yep.
but he did have that suicide note that he left to his fiance, and it said, "You're rich," because Massachusetts used to have a law on the books, whereas if you died while the case was in an appeal,
yes,
you were, you know, the conviction was overturned.
Correct.
And he thought she, I'm assuming he thought she would get his Patriots contract.
So, reiterating what you said,
yeah.
if he dies before he's been sentenced.
Well, he was already sentenced, but he was in the middle of appeals.
But in the middle of the appellate process, mm-hmm. if they die,
mm-hmm.
then the verdict is overturned.
Yeah. And Odin Lloyd's family actually fought it after the fact to get that law off the books. And they took the law off the books. So his conviction now stands and no money for his family from the Patriots contract, which they meaning the experts, didn't think would happen anyway.
Got it.
But clearly something in his mind. Well, I don't know how his mind worked because of the CTE thing.
Yeah.
But
let's take a step back.
Yeah.
Why Odin?
Why Odin? There's a couple different
theories
on that. Obviously, post-mortem, you don't like to talk about someone's sexuality, but there were a lot of questions raised about Aaron Hernandez's sexuality. So yeah. one was that he knew.
Got it.
Another one was that goes back to the double murder. He possibly knew about that. And
now, how did he know Odin? He met Odin, I believe, as the... He was dating somebody.
Yep, Aaron's fiance, Odin Lloyd, was dating Aaron Hernandez's fiance's sister.
Got it.
I don't know if there's an easy way.
Yep, so if they got married, it would have been his...
They could have been sister-in-law.
Gotcha.
Or, yeah, sister-in-law, brother-in-law.
Got it, mm-hmm. Okay. So they were pretty close.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so now, as part of the double murder aspect, Odin potentially knew about that. And potentially knew about Aaron's sexuality, potentially.
Apparently, they said he knew too much, quote unquote.
Got it. And I think that, you know, there's been a lot of documentaries and lot of things about that Aaron just did whatever he wanted.
Yeah.
Right? Whether it was in practice,
mm-hmm.
whether it was, you know, his use of marijuana.
Yeah, his college days were kind of wild. And the coach, was it Urban Meyer?
Meyer's from Florida.
Got him out of a lot of trouble back then. There's just story upon story from when he was in college.
Yep.
17 years old, he went away and, you know, he went away to college. He didn't go away yet, but he went away to college as a 17-year-old.
Yeah.
And couldn't handle it. And he had Tim Tebow as a mentor and everything. Still, it just struggled.
Yeah. So I have a question for you.
Sure.
When the investigators reviewed the surveillance footage of Hernandez's home mm-hmm. in the streets nearby the night that Lloyd was killed, what part of that timeline became most damaging to Aaron?
It was most likely the timeline between 3 and 4 a.m.
Okay.
They show him leaving with Odin Lloyd, coming home without him, and then the internal home footage from that time has him holding what looks like a gun.
Got it, mm-hmm. got it, which, again, they never really identified what that was.
Yeah.
Now, when you say that he was in prison,
mm-hmm.
right? He was found guilty,
mm-hmm.
and then he was in the process of the double mm-hmm. murder trial when he died of apparent suicide.
I think he already was acquitted of that, actually, the double, because he was acquitted in that.
He was acquitted of that.
Because they found the prosecution's star witnesses not credible.
Was that the guy that he had supposedly shot
mm-hmm.
himself,
mm-hmm.
was a drug dealer?
Yep.
What was that guy's name?
I recently watched the... documentary too to be prepared for this.
But he literally shot him
in Florida. Apparently.
In Florida, mm-hmm. supposedly he had shot him,
mm-hmm.
a big time drug dealer. And I remember because his eye,
because that's where he was shot,
was wacky. That's where he was shot. But he never threw Aaron under the bus.
Yeah, right? And also the defense said there was too much for that guy to gain. That's why he was testifying against Aaron
for sure.
Yeah.
So now talk about, so he's, who was the attorney in that case too? It was, cause she, he also represented somebody else that we had talked about on Debriefed.
Yeah. The woman that just was on trial, didn't he represent her? The one that was on trial?
Baez. Baez was his name.
Jose
Baez is who represented him there, because Jose Baez also represented, who was the little girl that went missing in Florida? And she said she worked for Disney. Casey Anthony.
Yep.
He represented Casey Anthony in that case. Mm-hmm. He also, did he represent, who was the DWI in?
He didn't represent Karen
Reed. He didn't represent
her. Yeah, that's what I was thinking, Karen Reed.
But the attorney looked a lot like him, though.
Yeah. I don't think it was him, though.
I do remember that. So we've got Jose Baez that represented him and the second one with the and got the not guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So now take us to that process now after they not guilty.
Like I said, he was in jail for the first charges, the first conviction, I should say. And his fiance talked to him, I want to say the same day, nothing out of the ordinary. With their conversation, people that were around him said he seemed chipper, for a lack of better term. That's not a great term for somebody in jail. But and then they found him and he hung himself, and he had, I think, John 3:16 on his forehead. And there were two or three suicide notes, one to his fiance, one to his alleged gay lover in prison. And I forget the third one, I think, was to his legal team.
And did they ever release what some of the notes said?
Not that I'm aware of. Other than like I said, what I, you know, other than like the part to his fiance that said, "You're rich."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, is there confirmation that there was three letters?
That I don't know. I think there definitely were the two.
Yeah.
You know how, like, urban legend almost, like these things just catch on like wildfire and spread.
For sure.
But yeah.
For sure. What surprised you the most in being a fan of this case?
Just that he was accused of it in general. Yeah. I went to training camp, I think it was that summer or the summer before, with my daughter. And the fans loved him. I mean, they're holding signs. And the Patriots have the most fan-friendly training camp, and like he was interacting with the fans because you're super close, and he's smiling up, waving, and you have somebody who has like their whole career ahead of them, and then you hear that, and you knew he was trouble in college.
Yeah, of course.
But there's a difference between marijuana problems and murdering people.
Yeah, of course. Now to the CTE, you said that you were interested in that aspect of the case. How did that diagnosis after his death come about?
The family donated his brain to be studied.
Okay.
To be, and there are four levels, four stages of CTE, four being the worst. And at 27, he was already at stage 3. And they don't normally see that in individuals until they hit 40, 50 years old. So that was fascinating. It makes you think, how many times has this guy been, you know, concussed and allowed to play and getting concussed again? And then there's other players, obviously, that I follow on that team, like, say, a Julian Edelman or a Wes Welker, who were always getting their bell rung.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't see that. And
let's talk about CTE. Like, what are some of the signs of CTE? And tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. I'm not a medical professional, so I did
disclaimer.
I did write this down. So especially where he was at in it, impulsivity.
Okay. I
definitely didn't pronounce that right. Aggression.
Okay.
Poor decision making, emotional volatility.
Okay.
Depression, paranoia, and memory problems.
Sounds like I have CTE.
Next time you're yelling, I'll be like, CTE.
How does CTE progress?
I know it does progress over time. It gets worse and worse. There's something called TAU protein deposits.
Okay.
Don't ask me to explain
Google
that.
Google it.
Yeah, please Google ChatGPT. But those grow and then the cognitive starts to decline. I mean, that's another thing that they see in CTE. Sometimes these violent, you know, outbursts and that those specific symptoms aren't seen in everybody. Sometimes it is just the cognitive decline, like Frank Gifford. That was one thing he dealt with.
Frank Gifford was a quarterback too, right? Right?
Was he a quarterback? Was he? I know he was the announcer for years. I don't remember what position he played.
Yeah.
Okay.
Married to Kathy Lee. Yeah.
Yeah. I used to love him. Kathy Lee too. And
she
got older.
She was wacky. Yeah. But Junior Seau, you know, him too. And he committed suicide. There was a wrestler, and I don't follow wrestling. But I think it was a murder-suicide with his family. Mm. There was another football player that killed his family. Yeah.
Are they doing anything now to prevent or have any testing to do to study it more?
Well, I know that they can't, right now, they can't diagnose it until after death when they can actually get into the brain and study it. I know the NFL has taken like the concussion protocols, so they're not allowing them to play until the concussion. And I know with the younger kids, they're moving away from tackle into touch or flag football. So these young kids,
they're not getting at an early age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because that's clearly, I mean, he's 27, stage three. That's clearly what happened to him. He must have just had his bell rung so many times.
Well, he was also a specimen. Yeah. And these NFL players, they're specimens. So they're just, there's so much collision and everything at that age, right?
Yeah.
They also have the helmets, the special helmets that they can wear. Not guardian caps, which are
younger kids.
Factors to
that
too.
Yeah, but it's just a sad story all around. I think
it is.
I know one of the things that the documentary touched on, and it really made you think when he got drafted by the Patriots. Everybody was so excited because it's the Patriots. I mean, I'm going to be biased, but that's the best team, you know, especially back then.
Back then, the best team.
Well, I mean, they did, you know.
Lose the Super Bowl.
At least they got there. Bills fan. But his family and friends that were interviewed were saying they wanted anything except the Patriots for him. Because it'd be like one thing for his friends from home to have to fly out to California.
Yeah.
They were a 2-hour drive away.
Mm. And so what you're saying is that him being so close to that.
To the bad influences. Yeah. And
because he grew up pretty rough.
He did.
He grew up pretty rough.
Yeah.
And in Florida, that was good that he left Florida, but because he was such an athlete, he got away with so much. And then getting drafted by the Patriots kind of just made it really easy.
Yeah, really easy to get back in with his old crowd. And
Yeah.
So it's just sad all around, I think.
It is sad. Just like the New England Patriots. Being back in the Super Bowl is sad.
Yeah, real sad. Real sad.
All right. The next case. Jen, was there anything else?
No.
All right. Well, thank you, Jen.
You're welcome.
The next case triggered a debate that reached far beyond the courtroom. George Zimmerman shot and killed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin in Stanford, Florida in February 2012. The case became a national flashpoint over self-defense laws and racial profiling before Zimmerman was acquitted in 2013. Savannah's presenting this case because she followed the incident involving racial discrimination, how they intersect the criminal law. Savannah, thanks for being here. Walk us through the case.
Yeah, so essentially Trayvon Martin was walking from 7-Eleven back to his dad's fiance's house. He had gone to get some candy and a drink. It was a dark, rainy night, and he had a hood on. And he was on the phone with his friend Rachel. George Zimmerman was a voluntary neighborhood watchman. Not a police officer, just, you know.
Just a volunteer in the neighborhood.
Yes.
No credentials.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Not that I'm aware of, at least. But so he's driving around the street and he sees Trayvon Martin and identifies him as suspicious because he's walking at night in the rain. So he calls the police and the dispatcher says, you know, no need to follow him. Like, thanks for calling. Like, we'll keep an eye on it, you know. George Zimmerman follows him anyways And as I said, Trayvon was on the phone.
So take a step back. So yeah. They said, don't worry about it. Yep. He continues to do it anyways.
Correct. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And the only suspicious thing was him walking in the rain on the streets. And
okay.
George Zimmerman, as the neighborhood watch captain, he's like, oh, I don't recognize this guy. And there's been burglaries around here lately. So he's suspicious.
Is that an actual, do we know if that's an actual true statement that there was burglaries?
Not that I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
There wasn't. We're going to make stuff up.
Works for me. But yeah, so, you know, and we'll get into this as well, but that's where, you know, implicit bias comes in and racism, okay. Yep. You know.
Legal term.
Yeah. You know, the racism that you don't know that you have, essentially. Yep. So essentially he thought he was suspicious because he was black is the claim.
Yep.
So Trayvon Martin's walking down the street. He's on his phone with his friend Rachel, and he tells her, there's somebody following me, after Zimmerman was told not to be following him. Rachel tells him he could be a rapist. Run. So Trayvon Martin starts running away. Eventually, George Zimmerman catches up to him, and they have a confrontation. How this confrontation went differs based on, you know, which side.
Accounts, yep.
Yeah. Yeah. George Zimmerman claims that Trayvon came out of the bushes and attacked him and was repeatedly slamming his head on the concrete. So George Zimmerman shot him in the chest
in self-defense. Okay.
Rachel, being the star witness for the prosecution, essentially says she was on the phone with Trayvon and she heard him saying, get off, get off. So she tells a kind of different story.
Okay.
So this happens. Trayvon Martin shot in the chest and he dies at the scene. The police show up shortly after and George Zimmerman's not charged. Essentially, they said that there wasn't enough evidence that it wasn't anything other than self-defense. So okay. He's not charged. And then eventually the media gets wind of this 17-year-old boy who's walking down the street in a hoodie who shot. So there's a whole lot of controversy and conversation about what happened here and the racial implications and why Trayvon was shot and killed. President Obama speaks up on it. LeBron James speaks up on it. A whole lot of media attention. And this is part of the start of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Okay.
So eventually George Zimmerman is charged after all of this media attention.
Now, do you think he would have been charged without these people saying anything?
No.
Okay.
I don't. They had already ruled it self-defense.
Okay.
Nothing else to look at here.
So they felt pressured to investigate it more.
Right.
Okay.
Yes. For this national attention. I mean, like I said, President Obama was speaking on it.
Of course.
I think he said something along the lines of, if I had a son, it looked like Trayvon Martin. So George Zimmerman is charged. He's charged with second-degree murder. It goes to trial, obviously. Before it went to trial, you have a question?
Yeah, it's crazy that they would go right to second degree. They go from self-defense to second degree murder versus manslaughter.
Yes.
Or something less.
Yeah, and there's a lot of criticism over the district attorney's office to do that, essentially.
Yeah.
Overcharging him.
Yeah.
And setting a burden that they probably knew they couldn't
reach. They probably couldn't reach.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah.
100%.
So there is a lot of criticism for that as well. Before it goes to trial, there was supposed to be a stand your ground hearing. Which, for those that don't know, stand your ground in Florida is essentially a law that says you don't have to retreat. You can defend yourself. You can stand your ground. George Zimmerman actually chooses to waive that hearing. And it comes out later that it wasn't actually a stand your ground case because, well, according to George Zimmerman, he never had the chance to retreat because Trayvon Martin was on top of him, slamming his head on the ground.
Gotcha. Now, what kind of injuries did he have?
He did have some injuries, I believe, to the back of his head, and he had blood on him. And another key witness for the defense, actually the key witness for the defense, was probably a man who lived in the neighborhood. I believe his name was Jonathan Good.
Okay.
He was an eyewitness. What he saw when he called the police was a black man on top of a white man.
Okay.
And then heard a gunshot.
Okay.
So
When George Zimmerman dies, we'll get his brain and we'll see if he has CTE.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting. So yeah, it goes to trial and George Zimmerman is acquitted of murder.
Crazy.
Yes.
Crazy. Now, these celebrities and everybody else, what's the outrage at this point? What's that creating?
It's just, as I said, this was part of the Black Lives Matter movement, but it's just creating this distrust in the judicial system and in the state of Florida, essentially, actually in the entire United States with these racially motivated crimes. And I believe they investigated to see if there was any proof that this was racially motivated, and they couldn't find any. But my question is what proof were you looking to find?
Yeah.
You just asked George Zimmerman, are you racist? Like, he's going to say no.
Yeah.
So.
And I'm sure that they've done research on George Zimmerman. What was his nationality?
I think he claims to have been Hispanic.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, because I knew that he wasn't white.
Right.
From that standpoint.
Yeah.
Do we know where he is now?
He's essentially in hiding. I did look into it.
Yeah.
He's been disappearing from the public eye ever since this all happened. Apparently his life was essentially ruined from this trial and the media attention.
Yeah, so I'm sure.
He's been laying low.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. Did they interview the jurors ever to get what they're...
The jurors were anonymous, so they were only identified by number. And also, I'm glad you mentioned that. It was, I'm pretty sure, all female jurors with one Hispanic juror, and the rest were all white. I'm pretty positive. I wrote that somewhere.
But females?
Yes.
Mothers. Interesting. They were mothers.
6% female jury. 5 of the selected jurors were white. 1 was mixed race and considered herself Hispanic.
Now, let me ask you, as a defense attorney, what do you think the strengths of the case were?
I think the strengths of the case were definitely the eyewitness.
Yeah.
Yeah, saying that he saw Trayvon on top of George Zimmerman. I think the strength of the case is also the almost all white jury, too. So.
Yeah, I think that's where you win or lose cases, right?
Oh, absolutely. Voir dire and selecting your jury is where you win and lose cases, I believe. Yep.
Now, during the initial police response that night, what decisions by investigators or the prosecutors helped fuel the distrust in the handling of the case?
Yeah, I mean, definitely the decision not to pursue charges against George Zimmerman until it became a whole thing and caught national attention.
Immediate no trust.
Just, yeah, right? They were just like, oh, there's this 17-year-old boy who's been shot and killed. Self-defense, case closed. So I think that sparked a ton
without
of controversy.
Doing due diligence to really kind of look into it. Now, if they had taken their time and provided support to show the evidence, such as there's a man that's a witness to it,
right. It
could have prevented all of that, right?
Right.
But we all know that race, unfortunately, is involved in so many of these cases, right? And the only difference is nowadays there's a thing called a cell phone where people can actually see it, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's really unfortunate because there's a lot of really, really, really good police officers, but then you have situations like George Furman, right? Mm-hmm. That creates this level of distrust and it just kind of perpetuates the problem.
Yeah. And I think you can't look at it as not having implicit bias, I don't think. If Trayvon Martin was a white man walking down the sidewalk, I don't see this happening.
Yeah, I probably agree with you. Or at least getting to a point where it escalates to the level of where it's at, right? And unfortunately, if it was a white individual and this did happen, I bet you the police handled it.
Would have charged immediately.
Would have charged him immediately. And that's where I appreciated the reason why you selected this case when you told me in that. Because you follow the cases that involve the racial discrimination. What part of the Zimmerman trial clearly showed how race really had a factor in the public's reaction to the evidence?
I mean, as I mentioned, the all-white jury, I think that definitely says something.
Yeah.
But I guess part of the case that I think that shows that it's racially motivated the most is the fact that he was suspicious. What's suspicious about going to 7-Eleven and going home?
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
Other than the fact that he's a black man.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. And tragic.
But the other thing
Like, it's crazy to me that they would allow an all-white jury when race is such a factor into that. Yeah. Like, where was the defense on this?
I believe
Or the prosecution.
The prosecution, yeah. I don't know. I know that the prosecution, I believe, actually struck one black man, but he was a black man who was very for gun rights, watched Fox News, things such as that. But as far as the rest of the jury pool, I don't know.
Now, how was that area? Was that an area that was affluent or?
I think it was a pretty affluent neighborhood in Sanford. Yeah. I mean, it's probably why they had a neighborhood watchman, you know?
I mean, that's very true.
Yeah.
That's very true. Anything else about that case?
I think that's all I've got.
Yes.
It's a tragedy.
Yeah, it is really unfortunate. The last case begins with four victims and almost no explanation as why they were targeted, right?
Yeah.
In November 2022, the University of Idaho students were stabbed to death, four of them, in Moscow, Idaho. Brian Koberger was arrested weeks later and in July of last year pled to a plea deal that placed him in prison for life. Megan chose this case because the victims initially appeared to have no connection to the killer, which crimes like that are really, really, really scary.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they actually caught him is crazy to me.
Yes,
so,
I agree.
Megan, walk us through this case.
In November of 2022, four students were murdered in their housing off campus at college. They were Kaylee Gonsalves, Madison Mogan, Xana Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin. Kaylee and Madison had been lifelong best friends that had gone to college together. Ethan and Xana were a couple. Initially, it appeared to have no motivation whatsoever. There was no connection that they could find. There was actually two other roommates in the house that were unharmed and even saw the killer and were not targeted for whatever reason. I think it was extremely impressive that they were able to link Brian to this case with how random it was. And it was an extremely brutal killing. If you look, you know, there's pictures of blood leaking out of the side of the house. That's how brutal this was.
Blood?
Yeah, dripping down the side of the foundation on the outside of the house. Yeah,
that's
so
awful. And really terrible.
Yeah.
Housing work.
Yeah. Not the greatest construction.
Yeah.
But
it was like basically a party house anyway.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Exactly. You know, more and more have come out since he's been arrested. You know, now there's audio clips and all sorts of things. But initially they were at a loss kind of. And so it was pretty impressive that it only took them a few weeks to connect him. And I think he thought he was going to get away with it.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Based on what I've read and seen about him, I think he thinks he's a pretty smart guy and thought it was the perfect crime. But he did make some mistakes that ended up costing him his life, unfortunately.
Well, his freedom. His
freedom, yes.
Right? It should have cost him his life, in my opinion.
Yes, I agree.
Now, take us back to where this happened and how they kind of got to a point where they figured out he could have had something to do with it.
Sure. So initially, there was actually another suspect. Madison and Kaylee had been seen earlier in the night on surveillance footage at a food truck talking to some kid in a hoodie.
Yes, and I remember that.
They thought maybe he had something to do with it. They had called him hoodie guy or food truck guy or something like that.
Don't wear a hoodie.
Yeah, no hoodies.
No hoodies.
Eventually, he was ruled out. They did find at the scene a knife sheath that the killer had left behind. And there was also footage of a white Hyundai Elantra circling the crime scene several times, not just one pass and gone, but kind of returning. And that was basically kind of the string that they pulled to unravel everything else. And then they were able to get some DNA off that knife sheath that did get traced back to Brian. And ultimately, that's how he was caught.
So they found his blood on the sheath.
Yes, DNA. They didn't really specify. They found his
DNA. Oh, could have been touch DNA.
Yeah, something.
Okay. And then they connected to Brian.
Yeah.
Okay. So now take us a step back a little bit further. So do they know why?
Not that it's ever been, told, which is kind of, I think, a big reason why so many people were disappointed in the plea deal he took,
yeah,
because
for sure.
We never got any answers.
Yep.
I know he was a criminology student, I believe. So
yep.
I think he just had this fascination with murder and things like that. There was, projects he'd done in college regarding serial killers and just kind of had this vibe about him where he was maybe just not quite right in
terms
of things.
He was super creepy.
Yeah, exactly.
He was super creepy.
Yes.
He was a teacher's assistant, yep. Wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember stories of some of the students talking about how creepy he was,
yes.
Regarding that.
Yes. He was just, don't get me wrong. I'm interested in true crime just as much as the next person, but he put it a little too far.
Yeah. I mean, I fall asleep to Dateline.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. But I'm not going out there experimenting.
No. So.
So you talked about the plea deal. Since that plea deal, what questions about motive or planning never really came out in regards to the plea?
How he selected this house in particular. Did he know one of them? There's been some speculation that he did. I believe it was Kaylee, and he might have had some sort of fascination with her, but that's never been confirmed.
Yeah.
The other three were just kind of collateral damage, and the two that were left unharmed, that's just a mystery,
yeah,
in itself.
It's crazy to me. I don't know what you guys think about this, is that they would let him take a plea without any of these answers.
Yes, I agree.
And I understand the power of a plea, right? Like, as a defense lawyer, I'm sure that you do too.
For sure.
But when you have cases that don't give answers to the families, because if something were ever to happen to my kids, and I want answers. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the number one thing of like, why?
Yep.
Right? Not that that's going to change anything, I guess, at the end of the day. But, like, what created this? Because, I just got done watching Mindhunters, right? Mm. Which is a great show.
Great show.
I'm bummed out that it stopped at season two.
Me too.
But getting into the mind of why this happens can potentially prevent it in the future.
Yes.
And the fact that they took a plea offer without answering any of these questions is crazy to me.
Mm-hmm.
At least not answering them to the public.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, valid. They could have got those answers.
True.
My understanding is that they didn't even tell the family that they were going forward with the plea.
Yeah, I don't believe they did. And the families were not thrilled about that, from what I remember.
Yeah.
I think he should have had to face a jury of his peers and own up to what he did.
Yeah, I agree with you. My next question to you, do they have the death penalty in Idaho?
Yeah, I believe so. I think that was part of the plea deal. Yeah.
No, I remember that.
So he
took the plea deal to prevent.
Yes, I think he knew he wasn't going to get out of that trial with a not guilty. So.
Yeah. My next question is to you. Do you think... I'm going to ask this to Savannah. How much do you think that the victim should have a say in things like that? As in, let me explain it a little bit better. How much do you think the family should be involved in whether a plea is offered or not offered?
That's a really difficult question, I think, especially going beyond this case in situations like domestic violence and things like that, where sometimes I think that's a really complicated question. I think
it's not a fair question.
I think the family's role and the family's views should absolutely be considered by the district attorney's office as somebody who's representing the people,
yep.
And should be taken into consideration when considering whether to make a plea deal or not. So I think the role of the families in situations and cases like that is really to be represented by the district attorney's office, by the people.
Yeah, and it's really hard because nobody has an easy job in this, right?
Right.
Is that they've got to represent the evidence and the people without, at the same time, creating trauma for the families too, right?
Right.
Because I don't think any of them want to go through you know, hearing what happened to their children and everything.
Right.
But I'm still curious, like, why let some go and others not go? Mm-hmm. Like, why this house? Was it a party that you weren't invited to?
Yep.
You know, all of those things. It's just crazy to me because, like you said, the reason why you got into it is just the sheer
randomness
of it. It seems like just like, let's go here.
Yeah, exactly.
But there clearly wasn't because he was found driving around the house. Mm-hmm. Yep. And not understanding that just kind of just leaves us all wondering, like, what the heck?
Yeah.
Right?
It's a very unsettling feeling to know that people are capable of doing something like that with no motive or anything behind it. And it's human nature, unfortunately, for some people.
Yeah. Should see if he's got CTE.
Everyone has CTE.
Every autopsy is now of everybody.
Is now tested for CTE. But yeah, it's very interesting when you have those type of cases that, you know, unfortunately lead to very, very, very tragic situations like this, right? All right, so let's talk about the pressure segment test. I'm going to go with Savannah first. Savannah, looking at Jen's case on Aaron Hernandez, how much weight should juries place on circumstantial evidence, such as the surveillance video and cell phone records that doesn't show a murder taking place?
That's it's a hard question as a defense attorney because I want to say none.
Yeah.
But, you know, they always say in the law, it goes to the weight of the evidence. You know what I mean? So as far as what weight they should give it, that's a determination you have to make on an individual basis with the individual circumstantial evidence. You know, if it's something like, oh, they just walked in and they're wet and you're assuming it's raining outside, like that's pretty heavy evidence.
Yeah, of course.
So it's really on a case by case basis. And I hate to give that like attorney answer of it depends.
Yeah. Well, that's what makes you a good defense lawyer, right? Is that you have to look at it, right? And as a defense lawyer, you know, you're looking at it from the perspective of on its own, it's nothing.
Reasonable
right?
doubt everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah. Right? But then you got this, then you got seems to be a gun, then you've got, you know, all of the other things that could lead a reasonable human come to the conclusion that he's guilty.
Right. And as Jen said, they tied it together in a very convincing timeline. Like the presentation of that and the ability to tie all those little pieces of circumstantial evidence together, that goes a long way.
Well, I mean, this is a little bit off topic, but that creates the power when you have money, right? Mm-hmm. When you have money, you can have a defense that can create that story. Whereas if you don't have money, now you're stuck with somebody that's working really hard, right? But doesn't have the resources to put together a story that's like that, right? And, you know, I'm confident that if, you know, Hernandez didn't have the financial wherewithal, that on his second case, he would have been found guilty, right? And then again, that just shows for me, and again, this is controversial too, where they changed the discovery rules back there to allow people to have better opportunities. Why I'm a fan of it.
Yeah.
Right. What's your thoughts, Jen?
On the discovery rules?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The new discovery rules are fantastic. They're kind of a pain, but
not for us.
They're definitely a pain, but it allows, you know, for other people, it's bail reform. Right. That's what we're really talking about when we're talking about that.
But we used to have to do discovery demands to actually get any of the discovery. Now they have that set time that they're supposed to get it.
Yeah. If you have the right to an attorney and the right to have your day in court and defend yourself, you've got to have the evidence. You need to know what you're going up against.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing I tell people all the time. No system is perfect, right? Mm-hmm. But too many defendants stay in jail for too long, and usually they're people that can't afford a lawyer, so they're staying in there, or they can't get bail, right? Mm-hmm. So they're staying in there versus somebody else that has money. They have the ability to bail themselves out and be an active participant in their defense. That to me is not fair, right? So that's why I'm a huge fan of that. Megan, now going to Savannah's case, do you think that juries struggle with the self-defense claims when when there's only one person that survives out of that.
Oh, definitely. It's very difficult to form an unbiased opinion when you're only hearing one side of the story, really. And, you know, if Trayvon Martin had not died, he might have had a different account. I'm sure he probably did. And
yeah.
So it's very difficult. They kind of are forced into tunnel vision and only seeing this one side. And if that's all I have to go off of, besides, you know, witnesses in two opposite witness accounts between right. the girl on the phone and the yep. guy who was the witness,
yeah.
Which, you know, are contradicting each other, it's very difficult for them to kind of maneuver that, I think.
Weird question. Do you think in New York, it's a different result?
You think so? I don't know.
Well, it probably depends where in New York, right?
I mean, yeah.
I think it depends on the time, too. Like, if it was today.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, too. But as far as the self-defense argument itself goes, though, I don't know.
Because everybody says in Florida or Texas.
Stand your ground.
Yeah. Stand your ground. Yeah. Even though I know stand your ground was not a factor into this.
Right.
I still think that in New York, it may have a different result just based on guns, mm-hmm. just in general.
Yeah.
Well, don't you think they probably would have investigated it a little more up here?
Oh, that's for what sure. I said.
Absolutely. For sure.
So at the very least.
Yeah. I think the whole case process would have been different. Yeah. Would mm-hmm. the result have been different? I don't know.
Probably. Yeah, it's very valid.
Probably depends on the county.
Right.
Definitely. Yeah.
Typical attorney response.
Yeah. It depends.
Now, Jen, in Megan's case, if a plea deal prevents a full trial, does the public lose the important answers about the motive and planning?
Well, I guess it's tough, right? The motive and planning, only he knew that.
Yeah.
Was he going to testify? Probably not.
Yeah.
So the public's not really losing anything but theories.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. That brings a good point. When a defendant does not take trial or take the stand, what do you think that – do you think that tells a jury – a level of guilt? And again, I'm talking about in a murder type trial.
Yeah. I know you're supposed to keep an open mind
for sure.
and all that, but I think in the back of your mind, if you have somebody going up there or not going up there, what are they hiding? Mm-hmm. I think working in the position I worked in all these years, I think the opposite. I think it's just a smart defense attorney not putting them in front of the prosecution to get them tied up.
Yeah, but if they're innocent.
Yeah, that still doesn't mean the prosecution can't try to tie them up.
Very, 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 very true. And and again, it happens all over the time, right? Mm-hmm. Where unfortunately one innocent person being found guilty is a problem, right?
Yeah.
But if you look at the cases, and I don't have the percentages, so I just can't do that. The percentage of people that are found guilty that don't testify on their behalf, I bet you it's probably a pretty high percentage.
Probably.
Oh, yeah. I would assume.
Especially somebody that goes to bed with Dateline. I see it all over the time where they don't testify on their behalf. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, you're the only one that can tell the actual story in this case.
Yeah.
Right? Because obviously somebody else is dead. Right. Yes. So you're hearing all of the stories of everybody else's. Now, I want to go on the stand. Now, there was a case. It was a ballerina case. She was a ballerina case. Mm-hmm. And she took the stand. When clearly she did it.
Yes.
She took the stand and she was awful on the stand. Yeah. And the prosecutor was fantastic in getting in there. But clearly she was guilty of it, right? Mm-hmm. She was crying, no tears, right? And so what the prosecutor did, which was great, and said, oh, let's reenact what happened. And she struggled reenacting what happened. She's like, well, did he come at? Because it was another self-defense case, mm-hmm. right? Where she had shot him. But then she's like, well, did you have an open hand or a closed hand? And she's like, I don't remember. So
something you'd remember if
something
you were really in that position,
situation, you remember. Again, now you can have a psychologist come across and say that trauma creates you to block that. And I totally understand that. But it's crazy. Mm-hmm. Cool. Anything else? Any other questions that came up? Curious?
I just want to sit here and defend defendants not getting on the stand now.
No, tell me. Yeah. I love that.
I just think with things like circumstantial evidence, if you can get the defendant tripped up on circumstantial evidence, that circumstantial evidence looks a whole lot more convincing. And I also think there have been studies done, jurors put too much weight on the way witnesses present themselves and how that affects their credibility. You know, if somebody's up sweating on the stand, it's because they're lying. Well, no, you're testifying in front of a bunch of people.
Of course.
You're nervous.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So it's just like the telltale signs that people look at to tell if somebody's credible or not on the stand are not reliable.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you, but the reverse also works too. So prosecution's top witness is not nervous. They could be sweating. They could be doing all of those things too.
Right. But with the defendant, like you're going to be nervous.
Of course, you got your life on the line.
Exactly.
Totally get it. Totally get it. So what do you think is?
I think it depends.
That's the catchphrase.
That was going to be the question. That was going to be the question. Do you think there should be something else? Do you think that I'm going to give you this layup here. Do you think that a defendant should be able to testify without the prosecution asking questions? Hmm. Like, how do you get your voice across in a way that is authentic and genuine without the concern of all of the things that you point out?
There's not an easy answer other than not putting them on the stand. I don't think that not having them cross-examined would play off well with the jury either. If every other witness is up there getting cross-examined and they're sitting there, why can't the defendant be asked the hard questions? Why can't we hear more from the defendant?
Well, if you made it a standard,
yeah,
right?
No cross-examination.
No
ever.
Cross-examine.
Well, that would be
creative storytelling by the attorneys.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Is that's the whole point I'm trying to make there, is that you need both sides to really make it a fair assessment. And here's the thing, and Savannah knows this, is that jury trials is a science.
Absolutely.
Right? It's really a science and an art. It starts with the voir dire of getting that jury, just like they did in the Zimmerman trial. Mm-hmm. Because if that jury has, you know, more African Americans on there, I guarantee you have a different outcome. Mm-hmm. It begins with that. It goes with being able to tell a story, right? A story that is like, oh, this makes sense. This self-defense makes sense, right? And that's what people don't really understand, is it's a lot less about the facts, because if the facts were beneficial to you, you probably wouldn't be in trial.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's about having a attorney that can tell a story, or defense team having a story. And again, to do that, unfortunately, you need to hire representation that has the ability to be able to do that.
Absolutely.
It's crazy. Anything else on that topic?
I think that's it.
Okay. Well, that's what we have, is three cases, three very different paths into the justice system, and one leaves us questioning more things than another. So that's our episode of Debriefed. Thank you all.
Thank you.